Welcome, everyone. You know, we're so excited to have John McAndrew join us today. He's an incredible singer, songwriter, pianist. And for those of you who are checking this out on YouTube, you just got to hear a full song from his new album. It's called Better Side of Me. And it is just really an incredible album. Nancy and I have been listening to it all day. And it's just really quality, strong songs, good melodies, and the words are just, they get right to your heart. And I think it's kind of one of those albums that will take you through your own life. It's kind of reflective in that way. But it's out now through Quarto Valley Records. You know, we've covered a lot of musicians that record with them, and with good reason. So check out johnmcandrew.com. So welcome to the show, John. How are you?
Well, thank you, Lisa. Thanks for listening. Thanks for taking time to talk to me about the album. I just feel really fortunate to be in the position that I am in right now. And with this record, we just love it.
I think it's a fantastic record. As I was saying, we're both like, this is good. You just settle right into it. And it's a listening record too. And something that will just, you'll just keep playing over and over. I think when I said it's reflective on life, did you set out to do that? Or is it just for me? Everybody listens differently and gets something different from an album, which is fantastic. That's the beauty of art. But for me, it feels reflective. It feels like you can go back into times in your life and some of the songs just hit home that way.
Well, it absolutely is reflective. And I'm always a sucker when I'm watching a movie, Lisa, when it says based on a true story, you know, something about that. Even though, I mean, we're aware that screenplays change a little bit and all that, but I love to tell stories. And when I do live performances, there's always a little story about the song. About 99.9% of the time is actually the way that it happened. Now, you know, I'm from Minnesota, and that's where I kind of learned to play live, playing at all the bars and the clubs. And I played every kind of music imaginable. And then at some point, I started to write music, my own stuff, you know, and mix it in with the cover songs. And I think that's taught me a lot. Because how do you, when you're playing songs by Lynyrd Skynyrd and Jerry Lee Lewis, how do you fit an original song in there? So you watch people's faces. But if you tell them this is a true story, and I have to admit, it's taken me a long time to learn how to write, you know, better songs and all that. And so I think this album is reflective of some old school kind of James Taylor singer, songwriter, storyteller stuff. And I'm glad we got that message through you.
Yeah, definitely master storytelling here. And, you know, I remember, you know, just as a kid, even getting into musicians like Simon and Garfunkel, which I'm not saying you sound like them, but it's that quality. Right. And like Billy Joel, you know, Billy Joel has that, Elton John at times, I'm just going from the piano side of what you do, you have this way of just like settling us down and listening. So it's like you command our ears to listen, which is good, because I think it's hard for people to do anything new or listen. We're junkies here when it comes to music. It's like, bring it. Something's new. We want it. We want to hear it. That's the fun thing about Spotify, but there's other things we don't want to talk about regarding that Spotify, but you get to learn and listen to, you know, we create playlists all the time, and I'm always like, we always do some kind of fun, silly theme of whatever's going on in the world. And you find all these new people and you're like, oh man, listen to this. But that's, I think it's really hard to get people, like you're saying, if you're in a bar. I mean, I did that for a few years and it just became like, how loud do I have to sing over beer bottles and shrieks and then, you know, drunk laughter, you know, and then you do get their attention and then someone's falling down, you know. I'm not saying that I haven't had that moment myself, but you know what I mean? There's this thing where it changes over to, you know what, I really want to just do my thing and get it out. But yeah, your album really does command our ears to, it's like a little compass saying, come listen, calm your mind and listen, you know?
Well, thank you. Know, I kind of had an old life and a new life. I won't get in a lot of details, but you know, a mental illness and substance abuse and all that stuff. And when I got into the new life, about 5 years into it is when I decided to write, you know, my own music. And I was playing at the Mall of America at a really large club. owned by the Gatlin brothers, and it was country music, and we had about a 7-9 piece band, and I had written a song and had a little single up, and I remember I think Boot Scoot and Boogie got done and the dance floor emptied, and then we played my song and it went over like a lead balloon, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm out of here, you know, Lisa. I'd had enough of all those years of doing that stuff. And I got a gig playing solo piano in a really fine restaurant, and people there were listening a little more. And then it kind of booted me in the butt to write better, learn more about songwriting. And eventually somebody came up from Nashville, and Muscle Shoals Studios is the place that signed me. And I went down there to do my first album. And, you know, they compared me to Paul Simon, but not for my talent, but for my stubbornness.
He is stubborn.
Well, you know, I get down there and I don't know anything really, but I could sing and play piano. But, they go, let us write some songs for you. And I went, nope, I'm writing my own stuff. As a result, sold 11 albums, you know. Wow. But it got me to L.A. and to some other places, which kind of, that's the way life works. It's like a pinball machine. It actually bounced me into Denny Seiwell, who produced this album.
Yeah, from Wings, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty epic. Well, you're in Nashville too, so you've got to rub elbows with so many people just on the flip side of what the listeners and music lovers get to experience, right? So you do a lot of session work as well?
Not a lot of session work. At the job that I work at, I do music and kind of spirituality stuff at a really special place called Cumberland Heights. And in the process of that, I work with a lot of musicians. And then I do work with a lot of songwriters and people. And I'll tell you, the thing here in Nashville, Lisa, is the songwriters. The old guys around here that made records with Elvis and all these great artists that know so much about what not to play, how to say a lot more and fewer words, just kind of simple stuff that I didn't get experience with as much up in Minnesota. I learned how to play, though, and Minnesota is really a great town to perform in. But I think the songwriting and the business is what I got surrounded with in Nashville and started to learn stuff I didn't know before.
That's interesting because, you know, we do so many interviews with musicians in the Midwest and the art and about art in the Midwest. And I just go, what is going on? Like everyone's talking Nashville, right? Memphis, you know, Vegas, LA, New York and all that for music. And I'm going like, but the Midwest has something going on in regards to the arts seem to be part of life. It's not a side thing. It's not a, I don't know. It's just like it's part of the makeup of quality of life for communities, whether it's public art, whether it's live music venues. It just seems that music is a very important part of it. And then like Wisconsin, I know you're from there too, in that region. And I go, what? I wonder if it is that you get those, you know, crazy winter weather that I know about shoveling snow, right? But I think when you have that kind of winter, I mean, I'm sorry, but I didn't understand cold and I lived in England. I did not understand cold until we got there. And Nancy and I, my mom, you know, Nancy and I were like, this, I mean, the sun comes out and it's not even warm. It's just going, yeah, I'm bright, but I'm not melting anything yet. And I was like, this is unreal. But I think because of that, you've got to do something to move forward. I look at like even the Pacific Northwest, how people paint their homes vibrant colors to keep like to uplift because of seasonal affective disorder, which Dr. Norman Rosenthal founded that movement of, or that he recognized that this is an issue. And so, and you think about grunge music coming out of there and because it can be depressing, honestly. Winters and dark weather can be depressing. And I think good music comes out of that because you've got to do something and you might as well make really good music and good art. What do you think about that for the Midwest winters?
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, you can tell by the way I talk, I'm still, you know, I'm Midwesterner. My wife is from Alabama and I can kind of round the edges off. But what I think is interesting is Minneapolis, for example, a lot of people in the business in New York and LA and Nashville all say, what a wonderful performance town, because people can play music, all kinds of music, and people support it and pay money. It's the same way. I mean, I was going to be an artist kind of out of high school before I got into music, and I lived in Pittsburgh back then, and I didn't feel the same community kind of thing. And I wish I could explain what it is, why Dylan, you know, and Greg Brown is a great folk singer from the Midwest. You know, the Midwest is a different place. And I think there's I got to be careful, but just a tiny bit of humility that comes from the way we talk, the way we act. We're not real big show out kind of people. And the art and the music and all of that expressive stuff and the healing, you know, the Midwest is a great place for the healing arts, and the Mayo Clinic is there, you know, and Hazelden, all these. And I, you know, I'm just probably, you know, biased, but there is something different about LA and Nashville and New Orleans and New York and Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a beautiful part where I came from. Playing music was something you do in front of people in small crowds, you know.
Mm. And that's special. I mean, I was watching your celebration of the album coming out, and you have a video, and I encourage people to go to your website to check this out. Go to johnmcandrew.com, and that's MC for McAndrew. So johnmcandrew.com, and you can see Better Side of Me. You performed at the Kulex. Everyone says it different. Kulex Woodshed. And I loved watching that. And then you had the founder of Quarto Valley Records get up and talk a little bit, and just to see it perform. And I know Fernando Perdomo was there, and he's been on the show a few times. He's done a lot of work with some of the musicians who come on the shows, like Dave Kirzner and just a number of people. He's like LA's go-to guy, I think, for music. I don't know what's going on with him, but he's got his hands in so many projects, and that doesn't mean it's watered down. It's powerful with everything he touches.
I'll tell you what it is he's really good and then really passionate, and he's just got a beautiful soul. And when I told you earlier, I went to Muscle Shoals, and then I got a record done and sent it to LA, and I met another producer that worked for Quincy Jones. Mm-hmm. And she ultimately introduced me to Denny Seiwell probably well over 25 years ago. And we've become friends, and I've done, you know, maybe 10, 11 album projects. And I was going to do another one with a producer in LA. He was in the film industry, named Ken Polk. And something happened to Ken's hand, and he got it injured. I'd already made my airfare and plans to go to LA to do the record. We had to cancel it. And I told Denny about it. He said, "Why don't you come out and stay with me, and we'll record a couple songs." And I know this dude, Fernando Perdomo, and he's an engineer. He's got a studio. He can play. He can do 10 things at one time. You know, what a deal. And we went to the studio. And we were going to record two songs, and they were Only You and Up on River Road, the first two songs on the record. And what you hear in that album is the basic tracks plus maybe one or two overdubs. And Denny looked at me and went, "What? You know, let's do a whole album." Mm-hmm. And that's when I started to figure out, well, Denny, his experience, my God, he's played with, you know, McCartney and Liza Minnelli, and Billy Joel produced him, and so Denny's expertise, and then Fernando. I can't explain to Fernando, and if folks go to watch the videos, I deliberately did a little section in that concert, which is just me and Fernando, so that he can just rip it up, you know, and show his talent. So he's really good, as you know, Lisa. Mm-hmm. But what a heart and what passion for music.
He does. Passion is it. Yeah, he has incredible, I mean, because, like, you can see how much talent he has, but he has incredible control, which, you know, it's kind of like, and he knows that I think he's a firewalker. He understands that line, and he like teases you with it all the time when he's playing, and he knows dynamics. I think he should really be known for his dynamics, because
and when we were recording, it's really tricky to have piano and guitars playing with each other, because they rub elbows. But Fernando and I, all through this album, have the most beautiful dance with each other. Mm-hmm. And I think I got to credit Denny, the way he produced and kept it simple so that we can hear that stuff. And I'm like a lot of artists. I kind of sometimes don't want to listen to my stuff because I'm afraid there's a mistake. But I hear more and more of this little dance between Fernando and I. There's a song called Gimme New Eyes that's on the live recordings. And if anybody wants to hear that dance, listen to that tune. It's just, you know, and music is fun, you know?
It is. It is. And I love the whole Kulak's Woodshed is just like, it's an institution, you know? And I think I haven't been there in person, but I've seen the shows, you know? And I think that kind of setting for your album is like perfect. And it's not too hoity-toity or anything. It's just like, come in, listen to good music. It's chilled out. It's relaxed. You're in a woodshed, you know? Come on, man. And it's so, you know what I mean? It's like, I think it's like being in, I hope more of this opens up, but it seems like the way the live music way is going, you know, there's absolutely establishments like in Nashville and places that, you know, have music going all the time. But I was thinking for like your style, like house concerts where it's just relaxed and intimate like that. It seems like a lot of musicians and folks like you who have these amazing stories to share. That is a way. And that's what I was thinking with Kulak's. It's like, I think we're going more into that actual, hey, let's have an experience and not try to listen over. Of course, there's venues and theaters to be, you know, in and opera houses and all of that. But what do you think about that kind of style venue?
Well, we picked it for a specific reason that we knew it could get recorded, number one. And then I had to come to L.A. And we had Denny and Fernando and I. And then Denny got Davy Johnstone, Elton's band director, guitar player, to join us. And then Steve Picaro from Toto. And when we rehearsed the day before, it just, you know, those guys lifted me off my feet about 5 feet in the air. And I went, holy cow, this is really, really beautiful. But ultimately, that small value venue and performing in front of small crowds is kind of the way music used to be. The larger the crowds get, and I've played for 40, 50,000, and that, you know, that's really fun, but you have to do a whole different thing. And nowadays, when you've got 50,000 people or 25,000, you got to sell them t-shirt. Everybody's going to want to make some money off it. So there gets to be quite a lot of sideshow stuff going on. And that's all fine also. But I kind of to come full circle, Lisa, a long time ago, I was doing theaters, like 800-seat theaters. And my agent, Ed Keane, who was still doing that, that's really comfortable for me. And I used to close with a song called Small Crowds. And I remember sending it to a record label. And the response is, that's really a dumb idea. Because They're nice. Just thinking about profits, and that's really good. I'd love to make some money, but ultimately, I think it's almost like an example of when you're right in front of somebody and you're talking to each other, you can hear each other a lot better, and the connection is stronger. There's more bandwidth available the smaller the crowds are, and so ultimately, that was just a really cool experience, and I was surprised, Lisa. We walk in, and I thought I was in San Francisco 70s, which I had been. And we noticed the cameras and the speakers and what a cool thing they had done. And so it couldn't have worked out better.
It's a cool vibe, too. But, you know, talking about, you know, labels, Quarter Valley Records, from the musicians we've interviewed before, everyone's happy. And it just feels like an honest setup, you know, and that's, I think it's important that the artist and the label get along because there's just so much shenanigans and throughout the years, I mean, even now. So to partner with them, what was that like?
Well, Bruce is amazing. And I have to thank, you know, Denny for getting me in touch with Bruce. And Denny, of course, had a relationship, still does have a relationship with Quarter Valley. And they're just one of the few record labels, if the only, maybe the only one I know, that Bruce only has to be concerned about the artist. And there's a part of the show where I talk about it. He really wants us to get our music out and help people like us. And he's fortunate enough to be able to do that. And so it kind of blows my mind every day, the fact that we're talking with each other, that he's hired a really good staff to do the promotion to get the music out. Some old experienced folks, you know, that know what they're doing. And that's the reason you and I are talking is because of Bruce's commitment, you know. And when I talk about it, I'm really fortunate. And to be a part of that roster, all those guys are so great.
Because they cover a little bit of everything, like blues and, you know, a little bit of everything. And you have had it just, they're into really good music, but you've had to have, you can't just be here, I'm a great talent. You've had to put in your effort over the years. Mm-hmm. It just seems that they're very much like, you've got to be serious. Don't be, you know, because at the beginning, sometimes when you're really good, not you specifically, but like at the beginning of a career, there's a dance between the music and the ego at that point. If you're really good and everybody's like, wow, especially if you're very young, that can happen. I mean, I've played with different guitarists. I'm just like, dude, you're not getting the whole song. It's about you're just into your solo and there's so much more than your damn solo. You know what I mean? And the rest of the band needs to be part of this. So it's kind of, I think that they kind of demand you be beyond that stage, way, way, way beyond that stage, and that you've worked it, that you are committed to your craft, and they pick that up with the musicians that they cover and do it to work that they work with. You know, you have to be up there and being professional and good at your music.
Yeah. There's some elements in the mix, you know, the gumbo of this thing. Having gone to Muscle Shoals and then to LA, I've been around a bunch of people that have a lot of experience, that are really talented, and that's their purpose in life, you know. And my purpose is much more than just making music. It's about, I think, trying to tell stories that people can relate to, maybe heal a little bit. I'm such a proponent of the power of music to heal, and the science is backing that nowadays. We know dementia affects every part of the brain except the part that remembers the music, you know, a song and the time. And so there's so many great musicians. And so I had to find a little niche, and I didn't look for it, but just what could be healing about this particular message or this particular song or the groove of it. And so when you get a bunch of guys like you see in that band, you know, that's playing at Kulak's Woodshed, I just feel that that's kind of our purpose for that night, you know, and I feel like that's kind of my purpose with my music, and I'm kind of sticking to it now. It might be a small niche. It's sort of Americana-ish. That's kind of the guy I am on the label. But if that's getting across, Lisa, God, what an accomplishment. You know?
Well, to me, it's very soulful, and it's got a spiritual touch to it, but not over spiritual, so it doesn't run you off, you know? What I mean? So it's approachable. It's very approachable and accessible. That's the beauty of it to me.
Yeah, and you got to be careful to kind of tell folks what you do for yourself, because I don't know what you should do for you.
Exactly. The word, there's a friend of ours, Shelley Wizen, is on our podcast. She's a life coach, transformational life coach. And she said one of the words that she would love to see banned in the world is should, you know, the shoulda, because, and then she says, as you say, it's like, you're going to shit on yourself. You know, I say shit on yourself, not the other one. And she's like, but that word, and I think that's funny because we're actually recording on National Shoulda Coulda Day, and which
beautiful.
I know, because it's the should, who's to tell anybody should. And if you're telling yourself that, it's all negative, man. Just move on. You know, the way, whatever happened is what happened for whatever reason. Right.
Yeah.
And I think it'll just, even if you try to change it, it's just going to come back. It's like, you can't. Yeah. So I think the should thing, you can't tell people, you know, like how we listen to your album and listen more than once, we're like, oh, this is cool, man. This is really, we're both going, this is really good, you know, and it's calming. And for us, that's what it is. It was like immediately calming, accessible, and you could just sink in. Like I was saying, it was just like, oh, this is really good. And it's going to be played quite a bit because it is just something you can, you know, it's not going to override what it, you know what I mean? It does its job.
And a couple people and I, you know, have said, and I'd like to hear that, you know, it gets better each time. And the shoulda, coulda, woulda stuff is what the Better Side of Me song is about. Denny and I and Fernando, we recorded 17 tracks total. And I made two or three trips to LA and then we did some stuff from my studio here. But we had 17 tracks and not a title for the record. And Denny's tough. He's a tough guy to sell. He's heard it all. And I'd write a couple songs thinking this is a doozy. And he'd go, nope, you know. And so at the very last minute where I work out at Cumberland Heights, which is the song Up on River Road is about a great place called Cumberland Heights. People can look that up. But I wrote The Better Side of Me in about 10 minutes. And it was about this shoulda, coulda, woulda is all fine. But at the end of the day, I'm a human being and I'm, you know, I fall down and make some mistakes. But at the end of the day, I kind of look at all that and hopefully you saw the better side of me, you know, somewhere. Mm-hmm. I didn't get stuck in this shoulda, coulda, woulda. And I think it's, for me, it's a big part of this learning the art of imperfection. There's lots of terms for it, but just being a human being, you know, and we can always get better. That's the upside, you know.
Well, we started this show, you know, with your title track. For those on YouTube, you got to hear the full thing because we featured it from YouTube. So you've got Better Side of Me. So you've all heard that. For those who are listening on all the other outlets, you got a little clip of it. I encourage you to go get the album everywhere, anywhere. Go get it. But in closing, what is a song from this conversation and that you would want people to hear on the album?
I think Only You, because it's just fun and it's about your wife and it's about just that moment and a present moment kind of thing where you meet somebody and all of a sudden you just feel like life's going to be okay. And it's I love blues and boogie kind of piano. And I think Only You encompasses kind of a sweet message plus just fun music. So, you know, back to back, those are the two. That's the first song on the album and Better Side is the last. And I think folks will enjoy that one.
Yeah, no, I love it. I do too. And, you know, Up on River Road is one of my favorite too. So you got the album out. So all of this good stuff is happening. Are you going to tour with it?
Yeah, we are. I'll be in Washington, state of Washington, beginning of August, and then some gigs in Nashville. And then we're working on a tour starting in New York City in the late fall. So we'll keep people abreast of all that. And some things are definitely starting to happen and it's pretty exciting. But yes, I'm going to get out and go play and for small crowds or maybe a couple of big ones and we'll see what happens.
You better get those t-shirts going, man. I'm telling you.
That's right. The merch.
Hey, you know what? T-shirts are always good. You know, I was going to say too, I think with you touring and taking this, because the live is, you know, it's fantastic, right? As well as having the album in hand. Yeah. But touring with this, I think I'm just going to say this personally, but your music is healing. And I think the way the world is right now, everyone could walk in from any walk of life, any political belief, you know, any kind of belief, actually, at this point, walk in, listen to the music and calm down and people can enjoy it in an energy without argument. That would be my hope. But I think your music has that kind of way of, we need it. The country needs this right now. I think good music and I think the arts are one of the things that are going to save us from ourselves, how we all behave right now. You know, we need that to kind of pull us back. And when you have music that is reflective, it, you know, you're listening to, you know, your songs, your words, but it does instill those reflective moments for the listener. And I think reflection is really good because it gets through those coulda, shouldas, right, as we were talking about, but it makes us move forward. Sometimes you have to go backwards to go forwards. And that's kind of what I'm hoping with the album, you know, that people do that.
Well, that's the best compliment. And when we do sit down together, we all realize we're pretty much all alike.
We're all flawed, man. And we've all done the shoulda, couldas, but stop it.
We have different color t-shirts once in a while, but we can get through that.
I know, really. Listen, just tie-dye them all. That's what I think. If we tie-dye everything,
you'll never know, right?
You'll never know. Yeah, just go, oops, you know, oops, here's a new color, you know, I think we've got a lot of movement. I do understand, though, why your music has ended up in movies, because it does give you those moments. You know, I always talk about music like yours, where you're on a bus and you're just listening to music and watching the scenery and you're not on your phone, you're not doing anything, but just listening and watching. And I think movies always need those moments, and your music has that for movies. Do you like doing, did you write for them, or when you do soundtrack work, are you writing for that, or do they come to you and go, I want to use this song?
In a very rare case, I have, but generally it's been songs that I've already done, you know, that fit the mood or the tempo of the song. And, you know, I wrote a song a long time ago for General Colin Powell called One Little Wagon, which was about his organization, a beautiful thing that helped kids. And I sat on it for years, and then all of a sudden the movie One Little Red Wagon came out about Zach Bonner. And the producer and my buddy, who was a part of my music, were in the trailer, and the movie was being wrapped up and it was done. And he played my song for the producer. And the producer went, I think he used a couple words, but I'll just say, are you kidding me? This is perfect. And so sometimes it's just by happen chance, you know. But if there's a visual component to the song and the story, it'll find a little place somewhere, you know.
I do want to ask before you go about your song, Birmingham. We've covered a lot about Birmingham, including the Civil Rights Museum and the Civil Rights Trail there. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, wow. Well, my wife, Nancy, and I, we had met when I went down to Muscle Shoals to record. And one day, our oldest daughter was planning to get married, and we went down to Birmingham where the kids live. And mom and daughter went off to do some shopping. And I said, I want to go see this Civil Rights Institute. I've always been very passionate about that stuff. And I toured it, and then I went into the 16th Street Baptist Church, and I met the pastor there. And I left there just full of stuff. And I, at that time, I was living long distance. I was still in Minnesota and Nancy was in Nashville. And I wrote that song, and I went to LA, interesting enough. And Morgan Ames produced that song. And then that's where I got introduced to Denny Sywell. But I wrote Birmingham. We recorded it, and I brought it down to the 16th Street Baptist Church. And I said, you know, I called him. I said, I got this song I want to play for you that I wrote about. And I remember knocking on the door, Lisa, and the pastor and another gentleman answered the door, both African-Americans. And the first thing they said to me is, you're white. And I said,
that's funny, because I was thinking that too, just saying.
And my buddy, Barry McNeely, was one of the fellas. He said, I wish I had written that song. I said, well, here it is, you know. And that started many years of singing at that church, doing events, learning more about Fred Shuttlesworth and the state of Birmingham. And I still have a real strong connection, you know, to what those folks did back then, you know. And so I'm really glad you brought that up. It's I'm really proud of that. And I got to credit Morgan Ames for the vocals and the choir and all that stuff that she put together in LA.
I think, you know, this is part of it, you know, it's part of our National Park Service, the whole Birmingham Civil Rights Trail. I actually helped. We were doing shows about getting it to be part of NPS, the National Park Service. And it did. And when the travel writers, Debbie Stone, went down there and she covered this and went into the church. And when Debbie goes to a place, she's like, if she could write a book about each place, she would, because she just falls in love with all the history and wants it to be told. I remember doing it, and it was so wild. The day her podcast was scheduled to air was like literally within hours of it actually becoming part of our National Park Service to protect it federally. And what's happening with our Park Service is a little sad right now with funding cuts and things like that. But this again is where music prevails and the arts prevail. The arts always tell history, and it tells the truth, I believe, more than any medium, because things can burn down, things can happen, but people remember songs. They remember, like you were talking about that earlier, you know, anything can happen in life, and a song will stay with you. An image can burn in your brain forever in your heart, you know. Arts do everything. And so I think it's so cool that you were inspired to write that and that you did and that it's kept going, you know. It'll always keep going. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, one of the lines in a song, and they did some stuff with kids in the schools, is the sun will always shine down on Birmingham, which is an analogy for the truth. You'll never be able to cover it up. It'll always, you know, burn bright and strong, and people keep coming back. The trick is to keep it alive and to keep the passion alive, because we forget. And it's just a part of being human. We forget things. And so hopefully we don't forget. That's why that museum is there. And hopefully it'll be supported and, you know, held up for a long time to come. Some really great people work there too. It's unbelievable.
And there's a Salem Civil Rights Trail too. Like we went through, it's just that history. And Alabama and Birmingham has so much to explore and experience. There's a new book coming out, Secret Birmingham, that Sherith Fluker, actually her interview is about to air. That's on Birmingham. We touched on it a little bit, but I remember when Debbie did this story again, this was like maybe, gosh, I'm going to say at least 8 years ago or something. I think it was right before COVID, 2018, I'm thinking, 17 or 18, and maybe 16. I don't know. But anyway, I remember looking at her images, and I'd been to Birmingham, but all this was still kind of new as they were developing the institute in the museum, and those sculptures of the dogs that attacked.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, we did this in this country. I did not know that part. And I lived out of this country so for all my childhood. So it was interesting to see this. And I was just like, and my background, like my teen years, was in South Africa. So I understand this history very well. And I was horrified. And at the same time, we had the Dakota Access Pipeline thing that was happening.
Right.
Yeah. And we did a show on that before it even hit the major news networks, because no one covered it. Native American Cody Hall called us from the Red Warrior Camp. He got arrested, as many did, to say what was going on. And at that point, I think Amy from Democracy Now, a journalist, she had been there. She was one national person covering it. I mean, we're little compared to that, you know, way. Uh-huh. And she was about to get arrested. And at that point, they had women, pregnant women, indigenous women. They changed themselves to tractors and bulldozers that were just bulldozing over their ancestral burial sites.
Yeah, I remember.
And they set the dogs out. And it was so weird. It was, the timing was so close. I was just incensed. I was like, are you kidding me? We're doing this again. Have we not learned, you know? Yeah. And so that's why it's so important to keep, like, music will keep it out there. I really am a big believer in that. And so thanks for doing that. And again, here we are at a weird time in our world. I think your music right now, this album, is going to do some healing for some people and make us calm down and maybe not freak out at everybody and everything. So Better Side of Me, everyone, it is out now through Quarto Valley Records. We're going to close with Only You. Thank you so much, Don. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And hope to talk to you soon.
Absolutely. You keep us posted. We're always here. Wherever we are, we're always here. We're only a computer away.
Show your better side.
All right.
All right. Bye.
Do you know there's something else?